back to the bin.
I went to the used bookstore on Tuesday, and that's what I picked up.
Oh, so. Interesting choice. Who would have thought that would be the book you'd pick for today?
I've only had it a couple days now.
Is that the first issue, or is that like the trade?
That's the first issue.
Oh, because when you held it up, it almost looked like it was bigger.
Yeah.
Okay, now I can tell. I've tried to avoid buying the books like that only because they just the volume of the books in my collection, because I don't turn them over the way you do.
I don't have to keep them, though. That makes all the difference in the world.
It makes a lot of difference. I pretty much buy what I'm going to keep. And I went to the local show. There's a local show every – it's the third Sunday of every month. And it's about 15 minutes from the house. And
nice.
It's $5 to go in, but a lot of times I get free passes, so I don't even have to pay that. And then there's, a bunch of dealers. It's all just comics.
Your discount.
And so I went there I went to last month's, and I got a beat-up copy of Avengers number 9, the first issue of Wonder Man, $40.
Nice.
It's in beat-up shape, but still. I got being a baseball fan and being a Mets fan, but if somebody was not always the same thing. Yes, if somebody were a Pirates fan, they would have the same thought process, I think, because I bought for $5 and a comic of the life of Ralph Kiner from the 1950s.
Wow, right,
for $5, in halfway decent shape.
Now, let me ask you this. I have a life of Duke Snyder, but I don't know anyone. My New York people are Mets fans. I don't know they'd appreciate the Dodgers.
I don't appreciate the LA Dodgers.
Okay.
But had the Dodgers never left New York, I'm quite confident I would have been a Brooklyn Dodger fan, because I grew up in Brooklyn. And from where I lived, it would have been four short blocks over to get to Bedford Avenue and take the Bedford Avenue bus right up to Ebbets Field. Nice. So I'm very confident I would have grown up a Dodgers fan had they stayed in Brooklyn.
On Earth Spataro. Got it.
Yeah, on Earth Spataro, in that alternate universe.
Well, so. I got to tell you one collecting story, and that is that. So I've actually been reading a little bit fewer comics this year, but I have a good reason. And I've told this story on my shows, but tell it here. And that's
a bigger audience to hear.
I want a bigger audience. I want your elite select cadre.
Hold on, before you tell the story. I'm going to interrupt you for a moment because I didn't say hello, everybody. This is Back to the Bins. I'm Paul Spataro, and my special guest today, and by special I put in quotations, is Professor Alan Middleton. I almost called you Quartermain because you are Professor Alan Quarterman.
That's it.
So anyway, I had a free night, and my usual cohorts weren't available, so I put up the bin signal, and look who answered. And before we started recording, I had a very nice conversation with Mrs. Quarterbin, who is clearly the class of the outfit.
Let's agree on that.
Can
we agree more than 100%? Yes.
Yeah. Well, she said you're coming up on 39 years married. If you want to stay married for 40, you're going to agree with me.
Exactly. Yes. 100%.
So now all of that out of the way, you said you had a story. Go ahead.
Yeah, because I have been reading fewer comics this year than usual, but for the last decade or so, I've been reading a lot of those old time pulp, sci-fi, and mystery magazines. The sort of digest size,
right?
Whenever I can get them for a cheap price, and usually in that world, $2 is about the least you can get those four. And then in December, a source for those just fell right into my lap. I got an email from one of the local LCSs, an email. It's going to go down in history. It's the greatest email ever. The shop purchased a collection of these magazines like in the days before COVID. So they've had them 6-7 years or whatever. But these are magazines that go back from the mid-50s up until about the year 2000. And over the last few years, when I stop in, sometimes I'll pick one or two up. So I've bought maybe 15 or 20 from them over the years. They price them between two, three, four, up to $6 or $7, depending how old they are and collection and all of that stuff. Of course, I try to skew towards the $2 and $3 ones. But needless to say, but as the year was coming to an end, the owner decided he needed the space back in the store. He was just done with these digests. So he emailed a handful of us who had bought these ones before. Again, the elite cadre. And was putting them on fire sale clearance at the magic price, 25 cents each, baby.
And, yeah, but how much is it going to cost you for the storage facility for these places, for these books?
Oh, not bad. I mostly had room for them on the shelves already. Again, these go up to $6, 25 cents. It's a jaw-dropping price. And I'm embarrassed to say how many I bought. It's in the triple digits. Let's just leave it at that.
Really? Wow.
But of numbers, not of dollars spent. Clarify.
Yes. Well. Okay. I mean,
let's not go crazy.
100 books would be $25. I am good at math that way.
Okay. Just checking. So, love them. So that's a good chunk of my reading time is headed off in that old classic sci-fi direction.
Which books are grabbing you the most in those?
These are the classics are Analog and Isaac Asimov's and fantasy and science fiction, but there are also a lot of astounding sci-fi. Some of the classic, like Amazing Stories, a classic title. So very fun. I'm going to try to work a couple of them into the old Quarter Bin podcast because I did get them for a quarter. So
yeah, I think that might make for a good listen. Now, if you tried to say to me, hey, Paul, you need to start reading these magazines, I probably would say yeah, and I might even say yeah, meaning yes, as opposed to just to placate you. But whether I actually get to the point where I did it might be another matter.
That's right.
But if you say, oh, I'm doing an episode on it, really, no problem to sit and listen to it. And
there you go.
Might be quite enjoyable.
There you go.
So I think it's well played.
So the only deal was that was in December. The only deal was Valerie, who you met, very kind. Very, as you said, very,
allowing. The superior Middleton.
The top.
The apex of Middleton Mountain.
See, the problem is most people who know me from podcasting, I'm their second favorite Middleton. As soon as they meet Valerie, I'm the third.
Yeah, and you've now dropped a third.
Anyone who's ever met our cat, I'm really down at the bottom of the list. So, man, oh, man.
Well, I'm going to also, this is probably not going to be posted till somewhere around the time that it's happening. But I am very excited about the fact that I'm going to be attending Heroes Con. And one of the people who I've talked to, I don't know, how many times have we talked? Dozen, two dozen, whatever, plus messages on Facebook and all. I mean, we've become fairly good friends over the years. I think that's fair to say. And yet we never have had a face-to-face encounter. So now at Heroes Con, we're going to have that. And I'm really looking forward to that. And I'm even looking forward to it more now that I've met Mrs. Quarterbin and I know she's coming.
Yeah, that's why I bring her along.
If I could only talk you into taking Emily.
Then we'd hit the jackpot.
In fact, if need be, we could trade Emily for you.
Wait a minute. But then I'd have to work at the bookstore where they work at. I just don't think I'm nearly as effective a bookstore manager as someone else is. So
I see you behind the counter and they say, you know, sir, what do you think of this book? Well, I wouldn't pay more than a quarter for it. It
looks a little expensive to me, but if you want to buy it, sure, whatever. Yeah, we could trade that off and Ed would come back fired. So I don't think that's a winning proposition.
That's one of my favorite stories with my friend Ken, who I've talked about on many times here. He's effectively my brother-in-law, even though there's not really a blood relation. His wife and my wife they grew up together. They're like sisters. Right. Yep. So we call him my brother-in-law. And he had a collectible store. He currently does an online collectible sales under the name Tuscan Trader. If anybody wants to look that up online, and he sells high quality stuff, but he used to have a brick and mortar store. And one time, he left his wife behind the counter because he had to run an errand or whatever, and somebody was just having a big dilemma over whether they wanted to buy something or not. They were just going back and forth and back and forth, and finally, she just had enough, and she pulled it out of his hand and said, "Clearly, you don't want to buy it," and she just put it back on the shelf.
Not how they train you at retail school, but okay.
But you know what? They don't. But I think as the person that that's happening to, it might make you want it even more.
No, I do want it.
Salesperson doesn't feel anxious to sell it to me.
Right.
He's not trying the hard sell, or she's not trying the hard sell. Maybe this is worth more, and she's second guessing that she should have charged more for it. I want it. In fact, I'll buy it for more if you want.
I'll pay you double now.
That's her. I mean, she's great, but she doesn't. You know, I'm not taking nothing from nobody. Put it that way. That's her personality, and I couldn't respect it more.
That's it.
So, what else has been doing? Any other big collectible news other than your giant sci-fi collection?
That is the main thing. That is the main thing.
And Heroes Con. Those are all big things.
We are also looking forward mostly to you, but I'm also going to get a chance to meet Derek Crabb, it sounds like.
Yeah, Derek has confirmed with me that he's bought his ticket.
He's another one on the list of never having met in person. So
and Aaron
scratch you both off the list. Boom. Yeah. Boom.
I've met Darren face to face, but I've never met Ruth face to face. Darren was local for work a few years ago.
That's right.
And he and I got together and had dinner together and had a wonderful time. But I've never met Ruth face to face. So I'm looking forward to that. Yeah,
she's nice. Wicked left hook, by the way. But she's nice. She's nice.
And then my Is It Yours co-host Sean Whalen is coming.
Oh, I've never met. I don't think I've ever spoken with him.
He's coming
with
in
him, so that would be great. Good, looking forward.
And I believe I'm on the wrong network for this, but I believe there's going to be a decent number of Fire and Water people there.
Yep.
I think they make it a regular thing.
Yeah. Unfortunately, Shag's one of them. But you know, you take the good, you take the bad, you take them all, and there you have.
Yeah. Well, Shag, I've met face to face. Shag, I was very
that's a shame.
Very pleased. When one of the times when I went down to Florida, Shag actually got in his car and drove for like over 3 hours to come and meet up with us. So I appreciated the effort he put into that.
And Shag and I
have had a good relationship for years.
When you are in the in the presence of both Shag and Valerie, ask him about the first time they met. That's all I can say.
I will. If there is a point when the worlds collide to that extent, I will ask.
Well, I hope. Well, between the numbers of breakfasts, lunch, and dinners, I hope many worlds collide.
I hope so. I'm not sure offhand who else is going to be there specifically. Well, Darren and Ruth introduced me to Ron Randall, who is known for his work on Trekker, and he's been on the show a couple of times, and he's going to be there.
Yep.
So it's going to, he and I have talked probably about 5 or 6 times, and we get along great, and it's another person who I'm just going to be very happy to meet him face to face. And I believe, no pressure, but I believe that Darren and Ruth said they were going to introduce me to Mike Grell.
He's a nice fella too. Yeah, I met him.
That's through them,
of course.
They speak very, very highly of him. Yeah. And he's up there on my list of favorites of all time. So to meet him, you know, I just get afraid that I'm going to be starstruck and make a bigger fool out of myself than I normally would.
My only solace in something like that is I'm not the first and I won't be the last.
I often talk about when I met Neil Adams at Comic-Con one time, New York Comic-Con, that is, and I had a chance to talk to him for about half an hour. When I first got there, I was like, I couldn't get the words out. I was so impressed by his presence. And then he was just such an accommodating person because he actually had me come out behind his table and sit down in the chair next to him and sit down and talk to him for a while. I mean, what a nice person he was.
Oh, wow. That's great.
I repeat that story, you know, fairly often because when you meet one of your heroes and they turn out to be that nice, it's a special moment.
Well, then let me tell you one nice story as well. And I think they're going to be at Heroes Con. That's the Peenies from ElfQuest, Wendy and Richard Peeny. When we went, it was Heroes Con 2 years ago, the last time we went, and M did come with us. And Emma just, because of their bookstore connections, got me a very nice ElfQuest hardcover at wholesale. And
I won't tell anybody.
And the Peenies were there. And so it was early in the con, but Emma and I, we split up. I said, I'm going to go over here and get Greg Rucka. You go over there to the Peenies. And their deal was first signature free, and then I think $10 for signatures beyond that. Okay, that's very reasonable. That's fine.
Yeah, I have no problem with that.
Yeah. So and I wandered over just at the end of this in interaction, and then got Richard Peeny signed it first, and then as M was getting out the $10 for Wendy to sign it, she said, no, it's the first one free for each of us.
Very nice.
And I'm thinking, you know, you're a team. You really don't have to do this. Every book is going to have both of your signatures on it anyway. So they're a package deal, and we would have had no problem paying the second fee for the second person. But they said, nope.
The other story of a similar nature that I have, and I've told this one on many occasions, but one of the cons we went to, in fact, it was probably close to 15 years ago, and it was Big Apple Con, and my son and I went, and I paid the exorbitant sum of, I think it was $75 to take a picture of the two of us with Stan Lee, and while we were there, one of the celebrities there who had a table and you could take a picture with him for $20 was Henry Winkler. And I've always gotten a kick out of Henry Winkler from Happy Days and Arrested Development and Night Shift. And so I said, you know what, let's go over there and do that. And, you know, you give his person that's there with him your phone and they take the picture. And so when I was giving the guy my phone, he starts up a conversation with my son, asking him about high school and all these other things. And then, you know, I started telling him about, oh, you know, I've enjoyed your work in this and that. And he was as humble as could be, you know, oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate it, blah, blah, blah. So he took the picture. It came out blurry. So then he took a second picture and it came out nice. I've posted it at some point.
Right.
And I reached into my wallet, pulled out $20, and I went to hand it to his person, and Henry waved it off and said, don't worry about it. And I thought, wow, you know, his whole purpose of being here is to charge you for this. Yeah. But I guess he enjoyed his conversation with me and my son so much that he didn't want to charge us.
That's great.
He's become a an all-time favorite of mine beyond what he already was.
And if you had told me that story and given me a multiple choice, I would have picked Henry Winkler, because that is completely his reputation. Just one of the nicest, swellest guys out there.
I recently read his most recent autobiography. Mm-hmm. I think he had one previously, but then he's got this one now. And it's, I mean, he's led an interesting life. Let's put it that way. He's been through a lot. I forgot the point I was going to make for a second. There was a point where he's talking about Happy Days, and he was talking about somebody who was on Happy Days who got a little big-headed. And clearly he was not willing to put the person's name.
Right.
Because that's just not his style. Yeah. He doesn't do that. I've pieced together in my mind who I think it was. Because he really talked about it in the context of talking about Scott Baio and what a good guy he was and how unassuming he was and how he joined the cast and he had no airs about him. And I started thinking, well, who could he be talking about that he's comparing him to? And I don't know what the actor's name is, but I'm thinking it's the kid who on earlier seasons played his nephew Spike.
Right.
Because that kid left and Scott Baio kind of took his slot on the show. So I'm thinking that's who he was talking about, that kid probably got a big head over the fact that he was on, you know, a hit show like that or whatever. And it probably was the reason he stopped being on a hit show like that. That's my guess.
I was going to ask if Winkler did the Leonard Nimoy thing, his first memoir, I Am Not the Fonz. And then his second one, I Am the Fonz. Did he didn't do that? Okay.
And then I just shared this with my kids who gave a thumbs up to it, if I can find it for you. I may have to edit this out because it's a visual, not so much an audio thing.
I put on my glasses and get as close to the screen as I can. Let's see if I can. Ah.
So just if I do leave it in, it's two pictures side by side. And the first one says, how I view myself. And it shows Henry Winkler as Fonzie holding a thumbs up. And then it says, how my kids view me. And it shows a much, much more recent picture of Henry Winkler with white hair and wearing, you know, a cardigan and just kind of looking very, very unassuming. And I saw that and I sent it to my kids and they were like, yep.
Yep.
That's you, Dad.
You know, but in my profession, we don't call this aging. You know, we call it becoming more distinguished. Okay, distinguished.
Yeah, I understand that, but it would be hard for me to be more distinguished than I already am. This, you know, the scale kind of has, you know, has a peak to it.
I didn't say extinguished. I said.
So, okay, enough of the shooting the breeze. Let's talk some comics. What did you bring for us today? What did you buy at the quarter racks that you decided to bring?
Well, first of all, let's not get crazy. If I bought it for a quarter, do you think I'd share it with you? No. 50 cents, friend. 50 cents.
That's true, because you saved the quarter books for your own show.
Exactly. So this is one. I'm bringing it because it's about the most recent comic I purchased. I went to Half Price Books a couple days ago, grabbed five or six comics from the 50-cent clearance boxes, and this was one of those. So when I got the bin signal, that was an easy choice. Again, literally, it was the nearest, newest to me comic that I had. And the 50-cent price, way better than $3.99.
Mm-hmm.
Cover price. All you got to do is wait 15 years. It's not that big a deal. Little patience. Little patience, right, Paul? It's a little patience.
I don't know how many more blocks of 15 years I have. Exactly. Wait.
So this is Widowmaker, number 1 of 4 from Marvel Comics, cover dated February 2011. Which is about 50 years newer than the last time we talked about comic books. So,
yeah, that is very true.
This cover by Jay Lee shows two of our lead characters in heroic poses set against a snowy backdrop. Now, at this point in 2010, this would have come out late 2010, Scarlett Johansson had brought Black Widow to the movie screen, but Jeremy Renner as Hawkeye was still a year or so away. So one current movie star, and one soon-to-be movie star. The story, which I guess we're calling Widowmaker Part 1, was scripted by Jim McCann, with art by David Lopez and Alvaro Lopez, and a quick internet search learned to me that Jim McCann, the writer, began his Marvel career in the PR department before turning to writing, and not for this title, but he did win an Eisner in 2011 for a creator-owned graphic novel that he did. And the artist team, David Lopez and Alvaro Lopez, have done a lot of work together, but they're actually not related, which, you know, given the history of family connections in comic books, I thought that was a reasonable assumption to make, but does not seem to be the case. And because it's the 2010s, even though this does claim to be issue number one, it's actually continued from Black Widow number 8, the 2010 volume of that, because comics got to be comics. So the Marvel Heroes Library website had a synopsis that I used as the jumping off point. And we start with a page that introduces our three main characters. We have Black Widow, Natasha Romanoff, and also Mockingbird, Bobby Morse. And we have a gentleman who is an ex to both of those lovely ladies, Clint Barton, a.k.a. Horndog. Oh, sorry, I meant Hawkeye. Sorry, it's Hawkeye. So a Russian delegation arrives at one of the Kuril Islands to meet with their Japanese equivalents, their counterparts. They're there to discuss the status of these disputed islands currently occupied by Japan. But the Japanese diplomats don't look quite right. It turns out that they're all dead, and there's this sort of being held upright by wires and such. Then a band of dark ocean killers led by Ronan slaughters all of the Russians, and in New York City, Hawkeye and Mockingbird infiltrate the upper levels of the suites across from the UN building. They find a dead man, Japanese security man and former SHIELD agent, killed by an antique ninja weapon. They discover a list of spies from all over the world who've been killed or are targeted, and Mockingbird is on the list. Clint and Bobby have been tasked by Commander of National Security, Steve Rogers, to ensure that nothing turns the upcoming peace talks into something that's not so peaceful. They listen to a recorded call for help from a compromised agent. Hawkeye sees Black Widow's face on this list, and he thinks he knows where the agent was coming from. Bobby arranges for Dominic to meet them there with transport and winter gear. Bundle up. We're going to Russia. 12 hours later, Mockingbird and Hawkeye and Dominic, this is Dominic Fortune, end up in Russia, 5 miles south of Yakutsk, also known as the coldest city on Earth. Or if you're of a certain vintage, like Paul and myself, Yakutsk is that place near Irkutsk that formed the Siberian Wall that was a strategic element in the classic board game Risk. Just saying. Although, when they say this is the coldest city on Earth, if they'd been in Central Ohio back in February, they'd think different. So they find themselves in a ski-mobile battle with KGB agents, Hawkeye shooting down a helicopter by firing an ice arrow at its rotors. They arrive at the entrance of an underground bunker where they're met by Black Widow. Natasha takes them inside to a red room where all the female agents in training have been massacred. Didn't mention this before, but the comic has a running count of the deaths in the issue. At this location, it's 16 for a total of 79 so far, for those of you keeping track at home. Widow says that the kill list was leaked to them for a sinister purpose. They didn't just learned it by good fortune and good spycraft. And they question the source that brought her there. Natasha opens a secret panel and discovers another antique ninja weapon. Dominic Fortune discovers internal surveillance footage showing the killers, whom Widow recognizes as the Dark Ocean Society, a Japanese black ops team. And just as things seem to be going pretty well, the Supreme Soviets arrive, Crimson Dynamo, Perun, Phantasma, and Sputnik, announcing that the interlopers will be sentenced to life in the prison camps, except for the one responsible for the murders, because they will be summarily executed. Black Widow tells them that peace talks between Russia and Japan over the islands is coming up soon, and a member of the Japanese contingent has been murdered. And the Russian ambassador, he's probably going to be next. And as we see, he is next. There's a group led by Ronan enters the ambassador's home and kills him and his staff. Perun then shocks the heroes, and they are carried off. And on the last page, Crimson Dynamo announces that the leader of the Dark Ocean Society is Ronan, an identity once used by Hawkeye. But fortunately, Clinton, he's got a remarkably persuasive argument to make. That's not me. To be continued. So 2011 Marvel, what do you think?
2011, I was still actively reading what they put out. I have since kind of fallen off that train. And yet this series totally escaped my my view. I didn't know this series existed until you very clumsily scanned it and sent it to me.
Look, and I know, and by that I mean, some of the pages are upside down, some of them are twisted 90 degrees. Look, Paul, I'm going to be honest, that was not my idea. Mrs. Spatero asked me to do that. It was sort of a podcast prep, half mental acuity test.
So anyway, kind of like reading a comic and playing Twister at the same time.
You know, which at our age should be pretty easy. So
at our age, playing Twister could lead to a trip to the hospital. But anyway, I was totally unaware of the existence of this book. And reading it, first of all, I'll say it was an enjoyable read. I don't want to bury that, but it served as a reminder that I'm not as knowledgeable in the 2000 Marvel comics as I am in the 60s, gotcha, 70s, and 80s Marvel comics. Because, you know, I remember Dominic Fortune appearing in Marvel Team Up as an old man. So then, you know, why is he young here? I don't know. Is that a next generation? Is he a legacy hero? Did he somehow get a youth serum? Did they totally get rid of his prior origin and recreate him? I have no idea.
But the important thing is, whatever serum they did get him, he ended up with a pretty epic mustache. And I think that's important.
I think he's always had that. Yeah. The old Dominic Fortune, the new Dominic Fortune. I also am totally unfamiliar with this particular, with the exception of the Crimson Dynamo, this particular iteration of the Soviet super soldiers.
Yeah, I was unaware.
So for me, you know, we talk about the old every comic could be someone's first. In some ways, this was my first with this particular group. That said, I thought it was an enjoyable read. I didn't have trouble following the storyline as it went on. I thought it was intriguing. It made me interested in seeing where this series was going to go. I assume, we'll have a reveal as to who this person is in the Ronin costume and, you know, what he's doing and why he's doing it. All of that. I'm guessing, I don't know if this is a four-issue run or a five or six. Four. So it's probably available in a trade somewhere. And we have a local library not too far, not in my town, but in the next town over. And you're allowed to, you know, it's still in the same county, so you're allowed to use it. And they have an excellent graphic novel section. So I may have to stop by there and see if they have it.
Well, because
I am interested in reading more, which we've talked about on many occasions, is one of the key components when I come to rate these books is, do I want to read more?
It is funny you should mention that, Paul, because after finishing this issue, I checked our local public library website to see if they had the trade, and they did. And I checked it out.
Okay, very good.
It collects, I think, some of the Black Widow ongoing as well. So it's got
That looks a little thick for a floor issue.
Yeah, got about 15 issues in there. And I mean, spoilers, I wanted to find out what happened next also. I followed the Spiteri rule, which is risky just in general, but.
To be fair, I don't know that it's my rule. I think it's just a criteria I use in judging these books.
But
it is, you know, to me, that's a key thing. If I read it and I think, well, I've had enough, then that really kind of says it all, doesn't it?
That is you sending yourself a message.
And that's kind of a standard that I apply when we're looking at the beginning of a story. Because there have been occasions where, you know, we randomly pick a book and it's in the middle of the story or it's at the end of the story. Now, if it's in the middle, if it's in the middle or the end, my then question I would ask is, am I intrigued enough to want to go back and see how we got to this point?
Right.
You know, or is it, you know, the question, some though could be totally inaccessible and almost have a gatekeeping way to it, that if you read that second or third issue, you know, if you haven't read the first, you're lost.
Yeah, that's the other test, is how well do they bring you right into the story? And with this one, it sounds like it was a continuation, but I don't think really. I mean, I think this seems like a standalone
story. I think it's almost as if you had an ongoing series, it's the start of a new arc.
Yeah, I think
that's I think the only thing you'd have from having the prior issues is more of a familiarity of just the status quo of the characters.
Yeah.
But I don't even want to be so harsh as to say if the second issue doesn't, or the third issue, whatever, if it doesn't pull me in, that's necessarily a failure, because there are some stories that are fairly complex. And if you've read the first issue, then the second issue makes total sense. But if you haven't read the first issue, the second issue is inaccessible. Right. That doesn't mean the second issue is a bad second issue. It just means it's not good as a standalone reading project.
Right. Exactly. Because we don't expect every chapter that we read in a novel, if we pick one at random, for it to tell us exactly where we are and who the characters are. And right. Pick up, you know, chapter 17 of the next John Grisham novel at random, I don't expect to be fully, I expect to be lost a little bit, but comics somehow we almost expect something different if we, you know, grab something in the middle of a story.
And I think about when I was I'm pretty sure this was when I was in elementary school, and in one of the reading classes, the teacher talked about how he or she, I don't even remember exactly who said it or why, but the teacher said something about, you know, if I'm in a bookstore and I'm considering getting a book, I read the cover, you know, the back cover, what it says, the inside cover, I'll read the first paragraph and I'll read the last paragraph. And I thought, like, I think now and I'm thinking, well, that could ruin everything.
I have heard people say that. I just don't get it. I do not understand that.
I understand. I'm
but
reading
that
the
is
back
not
cover.
The only time I have heard that, Paul. I've heard
I understand. I'm reading the back cover. I'm reading crazy. The jacket. Yes, I'm reading the first paragraph.
Yes.
I'm totally with you. Leave that last paragraph out, because you know, a lot of books I've read, you know, Stephen King books or no. You know, John Grisham or you know, Michael Crichton or you know, any of these authors. A lot of times there's kind of a little mystery going on as to what's going on, and you know. Let's just say, for example, you pick up Presumed Innocent by Scott Turow. The ending of it is kind of like a twist. I don't even want to say what the ending is for this 35-year-old story, or maybe older than that. But if you read the last paragraph, it's like, well, now I don't have to read the rest of the book. Anyway, back to this one, I definitely enjoyed this one. I thought the artwork, I like the artwork. It's a little different. It's, you know, like kind of got a thin line basis to it. There's a lot of panels that have no background to them, but that doesn't bother me as much as it normally does.
Right.
Because it almost feels like it's intentional to make you focus on what's going on with the characters so much. You know, so it's to get you to look more at the characters. I think the action sequences look like they're pretty well choreographed in it. Much like the story, the artwork is accessible. And I like that.
I think that's fair. Yeah. Yeah, I like the pacing in the, as the artistic element of that. You've got, it's a modern comic. You got some big splash pages with not many words on them, but you don't have a ton of those. You've got words with six panels, pages with six panels, eight panels, four panels. So there's a nice variety there. So I think that adds to the reading experience.
And there's enough meatiness to the story that you don't feel like you're getting through it in 3 minutes, which some, is the problem with some of the books post 1990.
Agreed. I guess we could jump ahead, but I will, in terms of grading, I'm curious as to your take on the cover, but I'll go first because it is different. That is, it is a striking J. Lee cover. It's stylized. Characters don't look realistic, and I would be very grumpy if that was the interior art, but that's different from a cover, to me. Mm-hmm. He's a very popular artist. He's got the elements, I think, of his style are here. Things are sharp, angular, almost sculpted, almost carved. Black Widow's red hair is not drawn in strands. It's like jagged shards of hair.
Ribbons
of hair. The faces kind of look like masks. There's a almost porcelain quality that I think he's known for a little bit. It's like the characters are iconic, but they're certainly not realistic. They're weird. It's a weird, uncanny elements there. It's like, it's not completely to my taste, but I recognize the uniqueness and I think the craft as well in it. Now, I would have given it a straight B, but it is so unusual that I would bump the cover up to a B+ just for it being kind of striking. Interior art, we talked about, solid, professional, gets the job done. I think the characters look distinct from one another, and then each character looks pretty consistent. Locations, are definitely different. Again, I really like the pacing. You've got some multi-panel pages, then you get the big open action beats. It's not flashy, readable, competent, exactly what you want from like a spy thriller comic. I'd give the interior art a nice, dependable B. And for the story, spies, international intrigue, bodies piling up, but there's some death here. Depth. There's also death, but there's depth here as well. Wouldn't call it realistic because these are comic books, but I have read a decent amount of Tom Clancy and Robert Ludlum, and by decent amount, I mean all the books they wrote when they were alive. We're not going to talk about the books they've written since they've passed. Okay, that's okay. But I think this handles that geopolitical thriller vibe well. Gives a comic book twist with the super Soviet soldiers, multiple cliffhangers, multiple stories, sense that the plot is going somewhere. So to me, it's a B+ on the story, and I give it overall a B+. Like I said, I read it and I hopped on the internet to see if it was on Hoopla or on the local library. And I've checked it out and I'm probably going to finish up at least these four issues, if not more, in the next week or so. So that's a success by the Spatero standard. So B+ overall.
I don't even know if I need to rate it now that you've executed the Spataro standard. Yeah, I mean, I'm very similar to you on this one. You know, Jay Lee is an interesting artist because I first recall being exposed to him on an Inhumans, it was either a mini series or a maxi series. I don't recall. And I found, you know, where I said the interior art in this is very accessible, I found his artwork to be a little daunting and less than accessible. And I had to kind of work harder to enjoy it.
I would get that.
I think he's well placed as a cover artist because I do think, if my memory is correct, that his style is more suited to poster images than it is to storytelling.
I would say that, yeah.
So looking at this cover, I think it's fairly striking, and it would intrigue me if I was in the comic store and I'm looking at all the new releases and I see this one, you know, in that grouping. There's a good chance I'd pick this up and say, yeah, I'm going to check this one out.
You know, there's one other element to a cover that I think is worth mentioning, and that's that the name Widowmaker is actually kind of a cool name. And yes, you've got Natasha right there on the cover, so you have the context for it. But yeah, it's a pretty good name. It's a pretty good name.
Agreed. I'm going to say, you said a B+. I'm going to say a B. I think, you know, I like it. I think you might like it a slight bit more than me, but I definitely like it. The interior art, I'm gonna flip what you did because you gave that a B. I'm gonna give that a B+. I thought the interior art was really solid. I definitely enjoyed the action scenes. I felt like they had a dynamic choreography to them. And I thought the static scenes were fine as well. I thought they told the story well. I think his use of panel size is very well on display here, where you know, you'll have a page where you'll have one big panel and three little ones, and you know, different sizes at play depending on what part of the story is going on. And I think they're used for good effect. So I'm going to say a solid B+ on the artwork, which I think is, you know, really brings me through it well. The story, I'm going to be B+ on that as well, just like you. I thought it was a good, solid story that made me want to read more. It made use of a lot of different elements. And like I said earlier, it wasn't one of these stories where, you know, 5 minutes and it's done and you feel like, it wasn't one of these ones where I feel like if you didn't have the entire miniseries in front of you, it's empty reading.
Right.
And that works sometimes. I don't even want to make it sound like that's a horrible, horrible thing. There's some mini series or maxi series where if you can't binge it, it leaves you a little empty. But when you can sit and read it from beginning to end, it's satisfying. This one was satisfying on a one issue level. So I think that's, well, you know, that accomplishes something. It's got, like I said, it's got a lot of elements to it. I think this is the earliest point where I've seen the Red Room with the Black Widow.
Oh, okay.
My familiarity with that particular concept comes from the movies. And that's what I'm saying. You know, it's one of the things that reminded me that my knowledge of these comics is not, you know, this era of comics isn't as solid as my earlier knowledge.
I mean, I am glad I spent a few minutes on the internet researching this. Otherwise, I would have said, well, you know, we got two movie stars and we've got a TV star in Mockingbird, but that was years away from happening too. So
Adrian Palicki.
Yes. Oh yes.
who's always stays in my mind as the failed Wonder Woman. And she played yep, Bobby Moore's son, Shield.
That's right.
I'm intrigued by Dominic Fortune and you know how he plays into this. I'm hoping he has a fairly big part as it continues, just because he's a character that's very, you know, they can bring a lot of life to him that I don't know about already. So I kind of like the Soldier of Fortune aspect too.
His inclusion seems so natural, so casual. I wonder if he's been in the prior Black Widow title as part of the crew, you know, at this point.
Quite possible.
But I don't know. Yeah.
Me neither. But I'm going to look for that same graphic novel that you have. If you want, you could just send it to me and then we'll just tell the library you lost it.
What's the price on it?
They won't charge me for it.
$39.99 US. Oh, okay. How about this? I'll mail it to you. You just bring it back to Heroes Con in a number of months from this record. No, that's not a winner either. Nope.
No, it's one that if I don't see it at the library, I'm going to keep my eyes open because every once in a while, one of the local stores or at a comic convention, they'll have trades for like $5.
$5, yeah. Yep.
And I think, you know, even with the 25-cent standard, some trades, $5 is pretty good.
I'll take it.
So overall, I'm going to also give it a B+, though. I think this is... This was a very enjoyable read, and it was one, like I said, that had completely evaded me. I was unaware that the series even existed. I do recall Black Widow having some mini series around that time, but I didn't know about this one. So I may go back and try and revisit that era a little bit. So I found myself intrigued, and I picked up, there's a mini series called Jurassic Park Dangerous Games. And it's been sitting for years. It came out in 2010, I believe. 2011, excuse me. September of 2011, it came out, the first issue. And I've just never read it. So, you know, 15 years goes by, you know, who even notices? So I picked up the first issue and I said, you know, let me bring this one to the show. And it is, let me give you the creative team. It is written by Eric Baer, who I'm not familiar with. Story consultant Greg Baer, who I'm not familiar with. Art by Jorge Jimenez, who I'm not familiar with. Coloring by Studio C10, which I'm not familiar with. Lettering by Sean Lee, perhaps related to Stan, and it's edited by Tom Waltz and Bobby Kerno, who I'm not familiar with. It's an IDW book. And the story synopsis is as follows. It is 11 years after the events of Jurassic Park films. The infamously brutal Nicaraguan drug lord Gabriel Cazares has used his ties with some people in the UN to buy Isla Nublar, complete with dinosaurs, from the Costa Rican government. Cazares and his henchmen have converted the visitor center into a walled fortress and pleasure palace in the center of the primeval jungle. CIA agent Daniel Espinosa is working undercover to infiltrate Cazares' drug ring. However, 3 months later, Espinosa's real identity is discovered. 3 days later, he is brought to Isla Nublar and thrown into the jungle with a dagger. He is given 24 hours before the Cazares thugs will hunt him down. Espinosa tries to survive in the jungle and wants to find a way off the island. Espinosa then witnesses a dinosaur attack and takes down a Parasophilus with his knife. His would-be meal is interrupted by an Allosaurus attack. Espinosa trips on a log and is knocked out. A pack of Velociraptors appear and kill the Allosaurus. The fight is shown on the cover. That synopsis doesn't mention the fact. Oh, yeah, it does. It's got one line here and I missed it. Someone announces that they have a guest. And that's how it ends. So it's kind of on a cliffhanger with someone approaching. Considering I had waited to read this for quite a while, I found it a little lacking.
Yeah.
It wasn't terrible, but I thought the artwork, although the images are fine, I think it does a poor job of pacing and storytelling. I think if you're following the panels, sometimes you could confuse who the characters are. So it took a little bit more work to read the story. And I don't feel like it's such a meaty story. I think this is a story which, if actually properly executed, could be a 5-minute read. And I think it wasn't a 5-minute read because I found myself stopping saying, well, who's this? And how did he move from this position to this position? It doesn't make sense. So the artwork, like I said, the individual images look fine, mm-hmm. but it is not, it is not an example of really good storytelling.
I thought it was, first off, I'm an educator, so I'm not here to school you, Paul. I'm educating the listeners. Okay. You mentioned, because I was going to ask you this, you mentioned that you were unfamiliar with any of the names in the credits, and there is one worth mentioning, and that is Greg Bear, who gets the story consultant credit. It's actually his son, Eric, who is the scripter. They're a father and son team. But the father, Greg Bear, and I have to say this because I bragged about my science fiction cred 40 minutes ago, he was a major figure in science fiction as an author in the mid 80s through the 2000s or so.
So I was very young then.
Exactly. Well, I understood. He passed away about 5 years ago, but he's a Hugo winner, Nebula Award winner, best known for hard sci-fi that tries to take the science seriously. And you know, his reputation has slipped a little bit just because none of his books have been yet turned into streaming TV shows or movies or anything like that. So the name Greg Bear has slipped out of fandom consciousness somewhat because of that. But also importantly for us nerds, Greg Bear is considered to be one of the 10 or so founders of San Diego Comic-Con. And so also from IDW's perspective, doing a big licensed franchise book like Jurassic Park, getting Greg Bear's name on the cover would have actually mattered 15 years ago. That actually would have been a pull, you know, part of the probably helpful in getting the comic off the ground.
But now, has his son
carried on
his legacy?
The son has done some writing, but not much in comics, and not at the level of professional accomplishment of Greg Bear.
I didn't think this was a terrible story. I think the concept is actually fairly interesting. I don't know if it's very realistic that a gangster would be able to buy this island, that the world would just say, oh, you know, who cares, this dinosaur's there.
Look, there's not a lot of things believable in the Jurassic Park world, but the UN pulling a bonehead move like that, yeah, I buy that. Okay.
There you go. Okay. I won't argue with that point.
So at least the jumping off point is viable.
Also, you know, you got to question whether or not they'd be able to actually successfully take over this visitor center and make it safe because, you know, what's his name? Mr. Hammond wasn't able to.
We've seen the movies. We know that's not easy.
I've read the books.
Yeah.
So, in fact, you know, for Christmas, my daughter gave me like a collector's edition of the two books together, you know, bound and, you know, it's kind of, you know, fancy looking so you could put it on the shelf and impress everybody that you've read them. So whatever the case may be. Like I said, I'm so bothered by the fact that I like the art style but don't like the art storytelling.
Well, that's interesting.
That really does disturb me somewhat. You know, the story ends on the cliffhanger with the saying, you know, there's someone off screen saying, looks like we have a visitor. And the person is saying it to the velociraptors, apparently.
Right.
And that is somewhat spoiled by the fact that the next page says next month, and it's got a picture of the cover from next month, which shows a redheaded girl among the velociraptors. And actually, I guess, holding a baby velociraptor. So, you know, you can kind of extrapolate that she's the person who said right. that.
Yes.
Doesn't take a storytelling genius. So I'm very torn on this book, though, because I feel like conceptually I like it, but in reality, I'm just kind of thinking, do I really want to read issue two? You know, go back to that standard. Is it going to be worthwhile for me to read four issues of this?
Yeah, one thing, or couple things there. This is one of the cases where you picked your book first, because I had two that I was looking at, and when I saw that yours was from 2011, well, I made these. I picked mine that was also from 2011.
So we have a theme.
So we have a theme. You're welcome.
It is rare that I pick my book first,
but it is. But I thought it was actually an interesting compare and contrast. There are similarities. You got spies, or you got, you know, intelligence officers. You got some national stuff. There are some similarities between the, you know, sort of the big picture of the stories. And but you hit on one thing that is totally, you know, when this is 2011. I started the Quarterbin podcast in 2013, and the promo that I recorded then talked about if you're tired of $4 comics that you can read in 4 minutes. Mm-hmm. And I didn't time myself, but it was pretty close to 4 minutes reading that issue. It was pretty darn close to 4 minutes. And the interesting thing is, I mean, it's not like the, so I had this comparison. You know, the Black Widow book, I mean, it's not like it's, you know, Chris Claremont 1982 level of writing, or Stan Lee 1967 levels of dialogue, but it was meatier. I mean, you said it, you know, it's just the same era, right? But it's that one was just a meatier read. You get through this one and I think, what exactly happened? Or, you know, or these 22 pages could have been maybe the first 9 pages of a pretty good 22 page issue. Maybe it just stretched out further than it needed to be.
Yeah, I agree. And what took me longer again was some of my confusion trying to put the artwork yeah. to the story.
Right.
It didn't have a smooth blend. And
I was not as positive with you on the art itself. I thought a lot of the characters were not exactly full manga or anything like that, but almost Speed Racer cartoon. They were exaggerated a little bit. The hair was sharp. Not quite, you know, Black Widow's ribbons, but eyes were especially squinty. I mean, just sort of weird things that just looked a little bit off. And to me, that was a bit of a disconnect where you are trying to ground your story.
I think the cover is an example of some of the problems with the artwork, actually. That looks like it's from whatchamacallit, Avatar.
Yeah, I'm just trying to look at these guys' eyes. These guys.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just.
I see what you're talking about. But the cover, the cover shows the Allosaur being attacked by the raptors with Agent Espinosa down at the bottom. Right. And first of all, your eyes are totally, I guess their desire is to make you think, ooh, dinosaurs.
Right.
Because you don't even notice him unless you're looking closely right. at it. And there's some confusion to the scene as to even the fact that the battle is going on between these characters, well, between these creatures, because the coloring kind of blends with it. It's, you really got to like look at it closely to see what's going on. And that isn't always by itself a negative, but in this case, I do think it is. I do think yeah. that there's an element of you got to work too hard to figure out what's going on through this whole book.
I like a few design elements about the cover. I like the fact that there's no words or anything on it, other than the most important words, Jurassic and Park. Those are mm-hmm. the two words that really matter. You know, weirdly in a in an otherwise naked cover, it's very cluttered. You know, it's not cluttered with words, but it's cluttered.
Yeah, absolutely.
which is kind of an odd thing.
Yeah, I'm disappointed. I waited 15 years to read this. So,
you know, if you just waited, you probably could have gotten it for 50 cents. Anyway, I'm just saying, I'm not here to judge.
I suspect I could get it for 50 cents now. And that's, you know, it took me this long to read it. I could have waited.
And I'll say when I got to the end of it, I did look. I mean, admittedly, I was already on the library website, but I did check. They didn't have the trade. And it's like, okay, well, I'm not going to go digging for it anywhere.
You're off the hook.
But I looked. You know, if it had been free at the same library, I would have picked up both trades, sure. But it's but I'm not dying to read issue two.
No.
If it had been readily available and free, sure, I would have spent another 15 minutes and finished the rest of the miniseries. And I think that's fundamentally the problem.
One of my favorite lines when it comes to the show is when I talk about issues like this, that if they're available, you know, from the library or whatever. And when I my comment is, when free is too much, then it's really not worth reading.
Look, I have run across 10-cent comic boxes, and I've left books behind. It's like you see that, and you don't buy the whole long box for $30, even though you could. You don't, because sometimes they are not even worth a dime.
Yeah. Well, if all they're going to do is take up space in your home and you're never going to sit down and read them and never want to read them, then free is too much money.
Yep.
So I'll rate this. I feel bad because I see the artistic ability in the renderings, but I think the choices are poor. And I think that's really more so than the drawings being poor. But when it comes to, you know, when it comes to sequential storytelling, those choices become critical. But even on the cover, the choices are, in my opinion, are poor. The layout is confusing. The coloring kind of draws your eyes to different places, and it doesn't really focus you. You know, at a glance, you just kind of see a blur, and you kind of see the teeth of the Allosaur at a glance. And that's all that kind of stands out to you. And then you have to really focus on it to see, oh, they're fighting on the cover, and then this other one is attacking the human. And, you know, if you're not really looking closely, you're not going to notice all of what's going on. And I think that's a critical error. You know, I talked about before, if you're walking through the comic store and they have the new comics out and you see it, this one isn't going to grab you unless you focus on it. And isn't the idea to get you to focus on it, you know, to kind of make you want to focus on it, which this doesn't.
I think the cover seems to be about the branding, the big words Jurassic Park in the top right hand side, and then just a lot of dinosaurs.
I think
that's
exactly right.
That's just the two elements they wanted on the cover, words and a lot of dinosaurs.
If I was rating this purely just on artistic ability, I'd probably give it a B. But when you factor in the fact that this is the cover and this is what's supposed to make you want to buy it, I got to drop that to a C. I'm putting the cover as a C. The interior artwork, it's a similar critique because I think the pictures are well drawn, but I think some of the characters are hard to distinguish from each other. I think the choreography of the storytelling is hard to follow. And some of that is the artwork and some of that is the writing because it jumps back and forth in time a few times where it's a little jarring and it doesn't feel like a natural flow. But just rating the artwork on it, I'm going to do the same thing. I'm going to give the artwork a C, whereas if the storytelling was better, this could easily be a B+. The story, I think you're right that this is 22 pages of a 9-page story. And I think that's got to fall on the writer just as much as the artist. Mm-hmm. So I'm gonna give a C minus to the story because it's just not as intriguing. The concept is intriguing, the story isn't. And overall, I'm just gonna give the book a C.
Yeah, I thought there were actually some design elements about the cover that I liked. I think I know what they were trying to do. And again, weirdly, there are no words and yet it's really cluttered. But I give it a B minus. That's basically what you, I mean, all of my ratings are just a touch higher than yours, I think, because obviously I'm a pretty sweet guy. Students love me. it was the interior art was my least favorite thing about the issue again. I think the backgrounds, like the settings are all right, but I did not like the figure drawings. The character designs really, really threw me off again. Speed Racer cartoons from the late 60s is what they look like. So this disconnect where the world and this international situation, and there's supposed to be some realism. I mean, Jurassic Park level of realism. Okay, I get that. But to me, the art was disconnected. So that's a C. The story, you know, I like, maybe they're trying to do something different. Like it's not a standard creature feature or like an action movie. Again, it has this political espionage, you know, you got mobsters, you got the cartel. I think maybe they're trying to do something there. So it's a little different from, what they could have done. However, as we said, it's just this, there's just not much there. It's like you go to an expensive, you know, it's like you go to one of your New York restaurants, one of your expensive places, and you order your entree, you pay the entree price, and what you get is something the size of a small appetizer. It's like, it may have been okay, but it's just not filling. There's just not enough there. So, you know, C+ on the story, and it's a C+ overall. So we're in the same ballpark.
Yeah. So I guess the bottom line from this is we recommend Widowmaker. We do not recommend Jurassic Park Dangerous
Games.
There you go.
There you go.
So thanks for coming on with me again, Alan. I appreciate it always.
Oh, it's always good to be here. Always appreciate the invitation. I always appreciate that some of your regular friends and co-hosts have like work and lives and they try to balance them. But,
you appreciate
I'm always here.
You appreciate that they have work and lives and we don't.
We do not. So,
well, in theory, you have work.
Yeah, you know.
Well, I hope everybody enjoyed listening as much as we enjoyed shooting the breeze on this. And thank you, everybody, for tuning in. And we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for listening to our show. And we hope you'll continue to join us each and every week for more good old-fashioned comic book back issue awesomeness. You can contact Back to the Bins to leave feedback, comments, questions, suggestions, and criticisms via email at bins@twotruefreaks.com or by joining the Back to the Bins group on Facebook. Back to the Bins is a proud affiliate of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, which you may find at www.twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is a registered trademark of DiManzo Corp of Milan, Italy. All rights reserved. Please take a moment to stop by the twotruefreaks.com site and check out their many other fine podcasts, won't you? Thanks, and we'll see you next week.